The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Football is a macho sport, and it's great when the leaves are blowing. And basketball's just right inside when all outside is snowing. But when spring is in the meadow, robins start to sing, that old familiar feeling. Come on home to baseball. Come on home to baseball. With a hot dog and a cold drink, you'll be feeling.
Bang, that's a reply. That's a great shot. Straight down the ground at half volley, and he's hit straight through the line.
Wonderful stroke. Absolutely wonderful. There wasn't any glaring by the fast bowler there. He just spun around and went back to his mark as that one fizzed past him. Beautiful shot.
Yes, it's bound to go down in history. V for victory. No England player make a century. The way they play, I was very pleased. The cricketers from the West Indies. The way they play, I was very pleased.
I think the line is so important as well. You've got to get Mark Taylor driving off the front foot. He hasn't scored a run off the off drive. See, that's where he collects his runs. Very sound and sensible when you're out with Nicholas on yesterday.
To Brent Johnson, one out, top of the seventh inning. Fresno 2, Tacoma 1. Santos in a jam. Johnson, his first year at AAA. From the set, he deals. That swung on and driven deep down the left field line toward the corner, and this ball is going to be. Oh, it's caught! It's not Jake Wald. That's the ball girl. Jake Wald in left field.
Oh, got him on the helmet, I think. Stuck down, took his eye off it. He'll be okay.
To the second baseman, Cano. The Yankees are back on top. World champions for the 27th time.
Come on home to baseball. Come on home to baseball.
Some evocative sounds there from the world of sport. Now, why, might you wonder, are we playing you a sports medley on what is, after all, supposed to be a books podcast? It's all because of a new novel, The Art of Fielding, which is all about baseball. Here's its author, Chad Harbach, on the essential difference between baseball and lesser sports, as seen by Mike Schwartz, one of five central characters of The Art of Fielding.
Baseball, in its quiet way, was an extravagantly harrowing game. Football, basketball, hockey, lacrosse, these were melee sports. You could make yourself useful by hustling and scrapping more than the other guy. You could redeem yourself through sheer desire. But baseball was different. Schwartz thought of it as Homeric. Not a scrum, but a series of isolated contests. Batter versus pitcher, fielder versus ball. You couldn't storm around, snorting and slapping people, the way Schwartz did while playing football. You stood and waited and tried to still your mind. When your moment came, you had to be ready, because if you fucked up, everyone would know whose fault it was. What other sport not only kept a stat as cruel as the error, but posted it on the scoreboard for everyone to see?
Chad joins me here in the studio, as does Guardian sports writer Andy Bull. Andy, do you buy Mike Schwartz's analysis?
I do, yes. I think it's a lovely description of that very unique quality that baseball has, where you have an individual playing in a team sport. The only other sport that's really like it is cricket. And the two sports have an affinity there, really. I don't know if Chad's seen much cricket.
Now, I have to explain that I've invited Andy along for a his and hers interview because I was intrigued to see how differently we read the novel. Plus, I thought, you might ask different questions, Andy. But first, one from me, Chad. The passage you just read is from Mike Schwartz, who, as I said, is one of five central characters. And he's someone who's given his youth, his health, and it would increasingly seem his future to his sport. Do you feel as passionately about it as he does? I'm interested in the difference between your perspective and the character's perspective.
Well, no, nowhere near as passionately as Mike does. I played a lot of sports growing up and a lot of sports in high school. And then I was a good athlete, but I wasn't good enough or big enough to play in college. So when I went to college, I felt very bereft of that part of my life then, and all this sort of time and energy that I had been devoting to sport up until the time I was 18, suddenly I didn't know what to do with it.
Tell us a bit more about the actual story. The first character we meet, and in a way the central character, isn't actually Mike. It's this character Henry, who is also slight, like you.
Like I was.
And he's a shortstop, and I have to say I had to Google the word shortstop when I started reading it. Tell us a little bit about that.
The shortstop is, I think in some ways, the kind of captain of the defense in baseball, and he's the sort of the fielder who's right in the center of the action and has the most responsibility. Henry is a sort of lower middle class kid from rural South Dakota, who is discovered one day fielding ground balls at a baseball field in the middle of nowhere by Mike Schwartz, and Mike brings him to Westish College and kind of takes him under his wing and tutors him and works him and boosts him up and kind of recognizes this genius in Henry and helps to sort of refine that genius and turn Henry into a real professional prospect.
Andy, is this something that could happen in UK college sports? I mean, he's a student, a fellow student who finds another player for the team. He's not a university coach or anything, is he? I mean,
I'm sure Chad will tell you. The US college scene is a lot more highly developed than we have in the UK, and college sports is a huge thing, isn't it? I mean, college football is massive, famously.
Yeah.
But the idea of someone actually recruiting a player and almost overriding the college authorities in the way that Schwartz does, I don't think you'd get that so much.
It doesn't happen necessarily in the U.S. so much either. But I think part of it is that Westish College, the school in the book, it's a small school without a great sports program, and that's kind of why Schwartz is able to wield so much influence within it, because just no one else cares about it nearly as much as he does.
Andy, I am absolutely not the obvious demographic for this book. You are the demographic. So I would like you to start asking the questions. I'm very interested to know what you want to know about it.
The first thing I'd ask, actually, is I wonder what you think about the idea of me being the demographic. I wonder if you're slightly paranoid about the idea that readers might be put off by the fact it's seen as a sports novel, which it isn't necessarily.
Of course, I wouldn't want people to not read it because they're not interested in baseball. Even though, of course, baseball is a very American game, there was the same kind of fear in the States that because so many readers of novels are women, that they would be put off by the baseball aspect. And but for myself, there have been very few sports novels that I've ever really loved or even liked very well, and so I never kind of, even just for myself, I never really wanted to think of this as a sports novel or just be sort of narrowly focused on the baseball team, which is why there's a sort of wider cast of characters, some of whom have actually very little interest in the game.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, that, isn't it? A lot of great writers, particularly American writers, have written about sport and often baseball. I was reading a piece by John Updike recently on baseball. Very few of them have written successful novels, or very few have tried to write successful novels about sport.
Of course, there are a fair number of sports novels, and there are some good ones. But, given the way that sport seems just sort of absolutely kind of central to American society and culture, I think it's actually surprising that there aren't a lot more. I spend more time paying attention to sports than I really want to. I find it pretty addictive, and I think it's because it's to sit down and watch a game, it's a very sort of novelistic and narrative enterprise, where you're going to get this pretty clear arc, but there's going to be all sorts of twists and turns that you don't know are coming. So that if you write a book that just sort of does that, it's going to be very dull. You have to find a way to treat the game, you know, that's different from the way the game itself treats itself.
One of the things you do latch onto that has a real basis in real life is this idea of what we call the yips, and which in your book you call Steve Sack syndrome, after someone it famously happened to, which is this fascinating phenomenon when a sportsman who's so accomplished at something suddenly becomes completely unable to do that. And they can often be very simple things in golf, for example, making a simple putt, or in the case of your novel, the throw from the field to first base.
That was one of the real first germs of the book, was that was as a fan watching this happen to these really good professional players and just seeing the, you know, these guys, they're so stoical on the field all the time. And, you know, they show emotion only in really sort of regimented sort of ways. But when this happens to them, it becomes sort of shocking and pitiful, because you kind of see them sort of mentally breaking down right before your eyes. And you're totally right that it's always the simplest act that they become unable to do. There was one really great infielder for the New York Yankees named Chuck Knobloch, who got the yips. He actually wound up moving to the outfield so that he would have to make a much longer throw, and so that being more difficult, he didn't have the same sort of fear of screwing it up. When I was thinking through Henry's Crisis, I was just thinking a lot about my own experience as a writer. I think what Henry goes through is, you know, pretty analogous to what a lot of people go through in a lot of arts, and even in just in the sort of the course of your life. But what's interesting about having it when it happens to an athlete is that it takes place in such a public forum, and so you're breaking down, and anyone who wants can just come watch for fun.
You could see the failure of nerve as having been played out 20 years earlier in the life of the college president, who is Affenlight, who's one of the five central characters. Tell us about the other characters.
The other two main characters are a father and a daughter, Gwert and Pelle Affenlight. Gwert Affenlight, he is, as you say, now the president of Westish College. He attended the school and then became a professor of English and then returned to Westish to take the presidency. And then he has a daughter who left home at a very early age and got married in a very ill-fated way, and now is in her early 20s and back home living with her father on the campus of this dilapidated little school. And so this is a kind of a sign of great come down and failure for her to be back at Westish with her dad.
But she's not only with her dad, but then she ends up sort of skirting around the field that all these men are having their relationships on, doesn't she?
I feel a lot of sympathy for Pella, because she gets sort of plunked down into this very masculine world where these sort of men with their sort of intensely silly problems that they're sort of worrying themselves endlessly over. And, I like her character a lot, in part because she, she has a sort of wider perspective, and she kind of can understand how silly the actions of these guys are a lot of the time.
There is a strong preppy subtext to this book, isn't it? It's not even a subtext. You are very conscious of belonging to a canon. You know, Melville, for example, it's not a coincidence that Westish College team is called the Harpooners. Mm-hmm. And Affenlight wrote a book called The Sperm Squeezers. I wanted to ask you about The Sperm Squeezers.
Supposedly, you know, Westish College is in the Midwest on the Great Lakes. It's not on the ocean. You know, the idea is that Melville had stopped at Westish for one day on a tour of the U.S. and had given one lecture there, and the school sort of latched on to this one visit and kind of built the sort of identity of the school around that. But then Melville does sort of loom over the whole book, in part just because I love Melville's work. Moby Dick is such a kind of bold and brash and musical sort of book and funny book that I always want to sort of use it as a model. But it also seemed like the natural analog in this book, because Moby Dick is so much about male friendship and the way that men relate to one another. The whaling ship seems to me like a very natural analog for the baseball team. The reason why I chose baseball instead of another sport is largely because I think baseball is such an interesting combination of a team sport and a very sort of isolating sport on the other hand. Of course, it's a team, so I got to write about the team dynamics and the relationships between these guys. But then when they're actually on the field, there's a real sort of spotlight shown on each player when he's in the action, and that just, it creates such pressure.
Do you think that an English novel could be written like this, with that touches those two bases so very roundly, the sports base and the high culture base?
It's a really interesting question there. I'm not sure it could. I mean, American writers have written more successfully about sport than English writers, and I wonder why that is. David Story's This Sporting Life is one of the only really good English novels about sport. I wonder if it's because Americans are able to take sport more seriously without taking it too seriously. In this country, I think if you take sport seriously, you tend to be looked down upon often. And the idea of sport as a subject for a serious, high-minded novel, I think a lot of people would find that quite hard to swallow.
You know, the period when sport has really become big business in the U.S., you know, this really began to happen in about the mid-'80s. It's really become such a kind of central part of the culture, and it's almost become, I think in some ways, the kind of central art form of American culture. You know, one of the things that I find fascinating is the way that we kind of encourage athletes to practice a kind of total devotion. We don't nurture our poets or something in the same sort of way. We don't give them the same, you know, because the whole structure of American sports from the time you're, you know, 5 or 6 years old up through these very serious high school programs and college programs, it's an enormous pyramid, and it's just such a central fact of American life. You know, so I think there's become a need fairly recently to try to understand why that is and what that means. And I think, you know, and I think the novel is a good vehicle for doing that. You know, in some ways, you know, the book is kind of the story of Henry kind of developing consciousness, you know, and it's only because he kind of has to have this crisis in order to get to that point in his life when he can sort of live as a actual full person.
There's a key quote from right near the end, what I think is a key quote anyway to me, which is, a soul isn't something a person is born with, but something that must be built by effort and error and study and love. And that's something that all your characters are going through in this book, isn't it? It's the tale of people going through that process.
It's sort of novel of education in a variety of ways, yeah.
Little boy in a baseball hat stands in the field with his ball and bat. Says, I am the greatest player of them all. Puts his bat on his shoulder and he tosses up his ball. The ball goes up and the ball comes down, swings his bat all the way.
Chad Harbach and Andy Bull there. Some interesting stuff about the great American novel, which set me thinking about whether there is such a thing as the great British novel. And even if there is, what is the difference? So I have invited Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website, in, along with writer Zan Brooks, to come in and discuss this. Sarah, you've actually read The Art of Fielding, haven't you?
I mean, it's interesting hearing a bit about what Chad Harbach thought about it himself there, because I certainly read it and thought this is absolutely right in the middle of the great American novel ballpark. It has that sort of authoritative 19th century arc to it, which just fits perfectly with my idea of a kind of a meaty, thoughtful, dreamy great American novel, I suppose. You know, it tallies completely with examples that we've seen back throughout the 20th century and you know, quite obviously all the way back to Melville, which is the main model that he's drawing on in his book.
But it's not just Melville that he references, is it?
The three authors who really are the kind of pillars of the book are Melville, Emerson and Whitman. And I think it's probably not a coincidence that those are also the three authors whose work supports the American canon, really. Whitman was the first American poet. Melville, you could probably fairly reasonably say, was the first American novelist. And Emerson was there right at the start of America, writing his essays about the American way of life. Their work is central to Harbach's novel. So, you know, it seems to me there's no question that he's writing within that arena.
Zan, I'm really interested by this idea, this construction of the great American novel. How did we? What is the great American novel? How did we ever formulate this idea? We don't talk about the great British novel or the great Indian novel.
No, it does seem to be a peculiarly American phenomenon. I guess it comes down to the idea of America being as much an idea as a nation, that it's a projection of Puritanism and the Enlightenment. There was this sense that it was virgin territory, that it was like a blank page and that you could almost write it into existence. I was thinking about this yesterday, and I was also thinking about in early American painting, the Hudson River School of like Thomas Cole and things like that. At the same time that Emerson was doing his Declaration of Literary Independence, you had the Hudson River School that went out into the Hudson River and painted American nature in this kind of absolutely romanticized way, that it was Eden. And so there was this sense that it was all there for the taking and it was the land of opportunity. And that sort of chimes with the idea that you can write America on the page.
And this ties in as well with the whole sporting metaphor, doesn't it? I saw you shaking your head when Chad was talking about there not being great American sporting novels.
Yeah, only I think because I suddenly then thought of a couple, but maybe he's right in that they don't come as thick and fast as you might think. I was thinking of Berlin Malamud's The Natural, which is a great baseball novel. There's a great book about being an American a sports fan by Fred Exley called A Fan's Notes, and it's about how you map your life out and your highs and lows correspond to the fortunes of your favourite team. So there are great sporting novels there, but maybe not as many as there should be.
But I think it's that sport, even in American novels that aren't about sport, sport often creeps in anyway. So yeah. All of
American Pastoral is about the Swede who was the great sporting hero, and then the afterlife of
and the same
that.
With the Rabbit books as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Again, the sort of the aftermath of being. And actually, that's interesting in terms of Chad Harbeck's novel, because this is the novel about when you are the great sportsman. Henry is, you know, the peak of his powers, well, or not, as the case, depending on whereabouts you are in the book. And those two, John Updike's Rabbit books and American Pastoral by Philip Roth, are both about the bit afterwards. So, yeah,
so,
maybe we'll get a sequel.
Embedded in this is this fear of failure. And I wondered how that might relate to the project of the great American novel. America, having thought itself very successfully at the expense of quite a few other nations of the world into being, is now at a point where it's no longer the great, possibly the great nation that it was.
Well, I think that's going to be absolutely fascinating over the next century when we inevitably, it seems, are going to see America on the slide and the East and China on the way up. And if the great American novel is about the intellectual invention of a country and writing a country onto the page, you can only do that if you have the confidence in the country that you're inventing, that, you know, is evident in all of these books that we've been talking about. Once that confidence is knocked, once it's gone, then you end up in the position that Britain is in now. And there are lots of great British novels, but we don't talk about the great British novel, because it would be inconceivable that we'd be able to come up with one, that because we don't have that view of our own country, I don't think, since the days of empire, really.
Well, having said that, Chad actually said that it's not talked about so much in the States. It's more in Europe that the idea of the great American novel is talked about, particularly in Holland, actually, in his case.
Well, maybe that's because if you are an American, then perhaps the idea doesn't really hold water anymore already.
I think he might be being a bit disingenuous there as well. I'm sure it is. It's certainly going to be thought about. Maybe it's seen as a bit presumptive to be talking about it openly, but this is what they're all chasing after. I think it was Frank Norris that said it was the hippogriff, that it is this sort of mythic beast that you're impelled to go out and hunt.
Yeah, or, how can you write a novel in America without having the idea of the great American novel?
Absolutely. Or, you know, it's to lift from another great American novel, it's like the green light on the end of Daisy's Dock. That it's kind of always out there, and you think it can. Sometimes you think it's so close you can reach out and touch it, but of course you can't. So then you have books like Philip Roth's The Great American Novel, that's kind of wryly riffing on the concept, or Chad's book with its, you know, Melville statue.
What is the nearest thing to the great British novel?
Well, I think it happened probably back in the 19th century. If you go back to the theory that Britain wrote great novels, or Britain saw itself as writing great novels when Britain itself was great, then that would have been, you know, the 19th century, basically. And you have all of the novels that we think of as our canon, and, you know, sort of particularly George Eliot, the Bronte sisters, people like that, Trollope, they were all writing then. And there is that sense in their novels of confidence and of the thing that the great American novel now sets out to do, which is to write a state of the nation in a sort of microcosmic way. The obvious example would be Middlemarch, where George Eliot has written about the state of the whole country in a little town. And, you know, it's a great British novel. It could well be the great British novel. It might even be the great novel, actually. So that would be the one that I'd go back to.
I think Tolstoy might be having a few wriggles in his grave there.
Maybe.
What about Dickens? We're all mad about Dickens at the moment.
We can't forget Dickens at the minute, his 200th anniversary. Again, what Dickens was doing, it seems to me, was writing about the nation and using a small situation and then extrapolating. And so you have books like Hard Times. Dickens was a very political writer. Books like Hard Times, which are talking about the Industrial Revolution, which started in Britain, was part of what made Britain great. And he tackles it and unpicks it and looks at the problems with it and the human cost of it. And that's, you know, that's exactly what we would expect from a great American novel now, to look at the sort of pressing issue of the times and then to unwrap it and to work out what it means to the individuals who are involved in it. And so certainly, you know, you might want to put that up there as a great British novel.
So what went wrong in the 20th century?
Well, postmodernism, I suppose. The first
was it modernism? Was it modernism?
Yes, sorry, modernism, I guess. Yeah, T.S. Eliot. I mean, actually, Harbeck mentions this in his book. He talks about it in the context of what happens to Henry on the sports field and getting the yips, losing confidence, becoming self-conscious and gaining doubt. And he talks about the idea of Prufrockian paralysis, which, you know, of course, you know, T.S. Eliot was an American, so it's an American idea, really. But it introduces to us that self-consciousness that also, you know, Freud had a big part to play in that. The First World War and our ideas of youth and death all came along at the same time. And Britain really lost its place as king of the world. And as a result of that, we can't write those books anymore. I mean, I genuinely think we can't write them. We don't have the mental capacity as a country to produce books like that, because it's too difficult to have that confidence to be overweening in the way that is required, because we're all aware of the ways in which we're a bit useless. And I mean, the British temperament also tends towards that, and probably the British temperament is a product of the 20th century life in Britain, I think. But that idea of, yeah, self-denigration, self-doubt, all of that thing.
I wondered whether the writing about the First and Second World War, of which we've been seeing more and more, particularly the Second World War, is an attempt to recapture that ground. And, you know, if you think of novels like Pat Barker's Regeneration trilogy or Ian McEwan's Atonement, they are dealing with big subjects, aren't they? Times a society in huge convulsive change.
They are, but again, I would suggest that when we're talking about the great American novel, we're not talking about historical novels. There are great novels written in America that are historical, so E.L. Doctorow's The March, for example, which is about the American Civil War. But it's not a great American novel in the way that other novels of his, The Book of Daniel, for example, also by E.L. Doctorow, which is about the execution of the Rosenbergs, McCarthyism, all of which is much more contemporary. When you're talking about authors now tackling the First and Second World Wars, then they can write great novels about it, but they're not novels about the state of our country now. So in that sense, they can't be the great British novels.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned the historical novel, because another of the big stories of this January has been the Costa Category Prizes. And the novel of the year was Pure by Andrew Miller, who's a Bristolian born and bred, but whose sixth novel takes him to Paris on the eve of the French Revolution in 1785. So it's very much a historical novel. He talked about it to Lindsay Irving and began by reading from the book.
He stands by the rope watching the men approach. He greets them, hopes they have passed a peaceful night. Then, with Lecoeur's assistance, he separates them into three groups. Those who will dig, those who will collect the bones, those who will stack them. When it is done, those marked for digging are sent across the rope. Earth, says the engineer, will be piled upon this side, here. When the pit is empty, the earth will be mixed with quicklime and returned to the pit. As for the bones, they will, in time, be carted across the city to their new resting place. He pauses. A few of the men move their heads. The others just look at him. The day is very still, a wintry stillness. Jean and her grandfather stand together quietly a little distance from the rope. Jean-Baptiste looks over to them. He smiles at them, or tries to, but his face is cold. And anyway, what would such a smile mean? He turns to the miner nearest him, Juice Slabbert or Jan Bilou, Jan Block perhaps. He nods. The man nods back, lifts the handle of his spade. The ground is opened. They dig for 3 hours before Jean-Baptiste asks Lecoeur to call the first break. There has not, in these first hours, been much to see. The dead appear to have been reduced to shards, fragments, as if the pit had churned them like dry bread in an old man's mouth. Are they digging in the right place? Was the sexton mistaken? He and Jean have gone back to the house, but after the break, the pit starts to give up its treasures, and every second thrust of the spade levers out some recognisable structure. A jaw with a row of teeth that look as if they might still have a bite to them. All the delicate apparatus of a foot, ribs like the staves of an old barrel. The bone mound becomes a low bone wall. There is no wood, not a splinter, nothing to suggest the men and women who went into the pit had anything more than the shelter of their own winding sheets. The midday meal is announced by Lisa Saget, beating a ladle against the base of a saucepan. Whatever discomfort the men have felt in their work, it does not appear to have affected their appetites. For the afternoon shift, three of the diggers are transferred to the bone collectors. Almost all those inside the rope find themselves at some point standing on bones. Besides bones, other things start to be found and passed up. A deformed metal cross, greenish. A brooch, mostly destroyed, in the form of a rose. Part of a child's toy horse cut from tin. Buttons. An antique-looking buckle. Nothing yet of any value. And if something valuable should be found, who is the legal owner? The man who uncovered it? The sexton? The engineer? Perhaps it is the minister. At moments, the men, all of them, seem swept by waves of disgust. Their eyes shut, they tremble, they hesitate. Then one spits in his fist and a boot or clog drives more resolutely at the edge of a spade, and the rhythm is restored.
Andrew Miller, this novel, as we've just been hearing, is built around the demolition and destruction of Les Innocents, the cemetery in Paris. I understand the initial seed for writing it was planted a long time ago.
Books often begin with other books, and this one's no exception. I read a short passage in a book called The Hour of Our Death by a French historian called Philippe Ariès, and in which he just alludes, really, to the destruction of this cemetery, a notorious cemetery in the centre of Paris. I think what was interesting to me was that it happened at all, that there should be this extraordinary place right in the centre of the city. Then the theatricality that sort of surrounded its destruction, the way that fires were kept burning continuously, that much of it was done at night. What really made it stand out was when it had happened. It happened in the 1780s, a few years before the revolution. And so it seemed obvious to me that, as well as being a kind of necessary piece of sort of civil engineering, this was also something to do with the new ideas, with getting rid of what was old, what had gone before, in a very sort of literal sense here, as we dig up the bones. But revolutions in a fairly sinister way tend to use words like purity, which usually means shooting people or cutting off their heads.
And there's a thing about the year zero starting again.
Absolutely, absolutely. I had in mind that there should be some clearing in order to start again, that there'll be this kind of new world will be possible. And of course, it's not.
It really isn't, no. These things are hard to talk about, but can you say a little bit about how, with this material, you came to settle on the figure of Jean-Baptiste Barat, who's an idealistic young engineer from the provinces, who's in Paris for the first time and charged with managing this demolition project?
I mean, he was my way in, really. I wanted somebody coming from the outside. He's a provincial. He's a young man, educated in a sense beyond his class. He comes from fairly humble origins. He's a rather insecure young man, and this job is possibly a passport to greater things. But it's also a kind of terrible job, and perhaps nobody but, an insecure young man from the provinces would accept such a job. Somebody who has capacities, he's a good engineer, but has the anxiety that he's right at the edge of what he might be able to do and that he might actually tomorrow not be able to manage.
Yes, and that sort of uncertainty of identity keys into the novel's concerns as well, because it's the broader concerns, because it is very much set in what we would lazily think of as the Age of Reason. And there are passing mentions of Rousseau, and he's been reading Voltaire. But everywhere, people are losing their reason.
And I think briefly there was this lovely dream that we would be able to clear away all the sort of the shadows from our thinking, and we would have these beautiful clear thoughts, and we would direct our lives with these beautiful clear thoughts. I mean, I think it was a very brief moment, because I think anybody with any sense at all realized that it just was never going to be like that.
You've set your books in lots of different places, and you yourself have lived in many different countries, or a fair old number. So I wonder, do you feel yourself writing in an English tradition?
Well, I probably am. I'm not sure to what extent I feel it, or am concerned one way or the other. Your writing is conditioned by your reading. As I was growing up, as I was at school and would have been reading English, British literature. So I guess it would be identifiable as coming out of that sort of tradition. You know, there are various writers I admire, but I don't concern myself with where I stand in relation to anybody's particular tradition.
The people who've read your early novels were recognised in this novel, the sort of full-colour historical storytelling here. But if they've only read your more recent novels, like Oxygen, they'd be forgiven for wondering if they were reading something by the same author, I think. Does it feel like a major shift in register, moving from novels set in modern times to historical ones?
I think when I'm writing books set in the past, then possibly I feel more like a kind of, I don't know, a sort of Fellini kind of character. I feel like I've got my sort of, you know, I've got some huge studio, you know, somewhere which I can fill with whoever, and with fabulous sets. And if I'm setting it something in the now, there's less of that feeling. And simply because the now can't be gathered up in the same way, perhaps. But beyond that, actually, the difference between writing something like Pure set in the middle of the 18th century and Oxygen set in the present is very little. Day to day, in terms of actually the writing experience, it feels very,
you're not
very similar.
Around in the archive.
Certain stories I want to follow happen to be set in the past, right. And others in the now. It's really as simple as that. I mean, I loved reading historical fiction. As a boy, I loved reading Rosemary Sutcliffe and stuff like that. So it's no great surprise to me that I should write some.
Andrew Miller there talking to Lindsay Irving. Pure is published by Scepter. We'll find out if it's won the Costa Book of the Year next week. We'll obviously be reporting on that. But before you go, Sarah, can you just run us through some of the other things that will be coming up in the next week?
Yes, in Saturday Review this week, we have a piece on the first sexual revolution, followed by a review of the book on which it's based, The Origins of Sex, in Sunday's Observer from Germaine Greer. And on the website, obviously, next week, we will have full coverage of the Costa Prizes and many other exciting things too.
Including your interview with Chad Harback.
Yes, hopefully, yes, with a bit of luck.
Which will be in G2 sometime next week. Well, that's all from us for this week. Thanks to Chad Harback, Andy Bull, Andrew Miller, Sarah Crown and Zan Brooks, and of course, Lindsay Irving. My goodness, what a lot of people. Thanks also to our producer, Tim Mabey, who has somehow managed to get them all into this podcast. From me, Claire Armistead, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.